Eric Asimov spit every sip he took. So
no, he didn't. He spit. I feel like I saw him drink a little bit. Did he keep the knife?
No, wait, I think I cut the knife.
Wait, are we recording? Will this be on the show?
Yes.
I just won $100. My prop bet paid off. I should have put a multiplier on it for in the first 5 minutes.
Oh, for mentioning Eric Asimov?
Yeah. Oh, did we mention that we interviewed Eric Asimov once? That's weird.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
I will donate the $100 to a good charity.
Yeah, that's fair.
It's cool how we just, you know, even though we're renegade wine people, we cling to the one shred of legitimacy we've been given.
Like, it's understandable.
It's fucked up. I mean, I feel like, you know, we're supposed to be like, no to all of them, but he does Taekwondo, which I really like about him.
Yeah, it's cool.
We even talked about my crush for a while, but he's so cool.
It's gorgeous.
I was thinking about how it's actually really fair and good that this pandemic has lasted this long, because it would have been rude if, like, some people had a pandemic birthday and some people just, like, got to have a normal birthday. And now, at least this way, everyone had at least one birthday fucked up.
That's true, Kevin.
It's fair.
I love justice.
Justice.
This is the concept I really want to drill down. Yeah, this is 100% that.
Yeah.
I'm coming up on my second Corona birthday.
That's exciting, yeah.
My birthday last year, I was upstate. And then when I came home, this is a story that everyone loves to hear. I saw ambulances everywhere and sirens, and I realized that, like, things had been going really crazy, and I just didn't notice them.
Yeah.
But early March is when things started to pop off. You guys got it worse in Oregon, didn't you? It was like fucking super duper crazy.
No,
okay.
There was an early kind of focus on some stuff that happened in Seattle.
Okay,
where particularly bad early outbreaks, sort of before everywhere was fucked. Mm-hmm. So there was sort of a lot of attention paid to it in Seattle, but in Portland, or at least in Multnomah County, we're trying to kind of do our best, like, New Zealand impression.
Okay. And those are different places?
They are, yes.
About
that more. yes, different places.
I do know this. I have this theory that, and I'm sorry, like, we're not supposed to make fun of Portland, but. In the Pacific Northwest in general. But I that people outside of the area don't immediately remember which one's on top and which one's on bottom when it comes to Oregon and Washington. I don't think people actually remember.
Well, yeah, cause Seattle's tough Portland, right?
Seattle's, like, expensive. It's, like, expensive
Portland. Yeah, expensive Portland.
Okay.
And then what's Portland's... Yeah, okay. Okay. But I do think people in their minds have to be like the way when I write the word friend, I always have to think I before E before in the middle of it to make sure I don't fuck it up. And also when I'm thinking about which is on top, Washington or Oregon, I have to like be like, right, Washington's on top. Okay, got it.
Oh, it's like a coral snake and a king snake. Black and yellow, kill a fellow. Yellow and black.
You're fine, Jack.
You're fine, Jack. don't be whack. Bring the snake home.
I guess the inverse of this would be like the rest of the country is meant to remember like which horrible Brooklyn subway station is worth an extra $10,000 a year in rent to live near.
Yeah.
Kevin lives in Queens.
Barely.
Is that that worse?
It's okay.
It's worse. But it's cheaper. No, you're absolutely right. It's like, oh, I'm supposed to know, which taco place is really cool in Brooklyn now.
Yeah.
The answer is all the ones with the birria tacos.
I'm already sick of them. I haven't even had one. they began at the beginning of the pandemic, and everyone's doing it. And, like, all the fusion food places are doing it now. Yeah. And it's just, like, it reminds me when I lived abroad and, like, seeing, like, all these food trends happen that I didn't touch.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, I'm ready for the next thing. Birria tacos, you're over.
Did you ever have a cronut?
Yes, I had one in London. I had a knockoff cronut.
Yeah, I had a knockoff cronut here. I had one, and I was like, okay, that's cool.
Chill. How about you, Jordan? Have you ever cronut before? We ask all of our guests this.
I have. Yes, I have had a cronut. Cool. It was fine.
Do they still exist?
I bet you could find one. So you guys are probably listening and wondering, well, what kind of podcast is this? This is Hello, Welcome to Disgorgeous. It's a podcast about wine. My name is Duck.
Hi there. I'm the dumb one. Our guest today is Jordan Michaelman, a wine journalist of many institutions, including Sprudge. Welcome, Hello. Jordan.
Hi.
Hey, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So we've been just absolutely demolishing the Pacific Northwest in this series. We have decided, of course, to break it up into categories based solely on vibe, which is, I honestly think is how like Jancis and Eric will be doing it in the future. But this is, we're trailblazers here, and we've invited you on to be our only expert.
Wow. So
thanks.
Well, thanks for having me. I was curious to ask at the top of this, have either of you actually been here before?
Oh, I don't need to do that. I went to the airport once.
Which airport?
Oh, maybe I went to the airport in Seattle. I went to an airport that has a famous fucking... One of them has a famous carpet, and
you went
it's
to SeaTac,
like,
right?
I don't fucking know. There was a 99% Invisible episode about the carpet. I went to that one. If you can avoid scintillating conversation for a second, famous airport.
It's carpet. The one in Portland has okay. the carpet. It's
the I saw old, the carpet.
The old carpet at it that people decided was cool.
Yeah, I've been in Portland for a day.
Yeah.
And then I spent the night in Eugene, Oregon, and then I was out of the state. I spent a day in Seattle. I was in a band that was touring, so I drove through. I didn't go to any wineries. I didn't do anything like that.
There was a secret plan for us to do to visit Oregon winemakers before the Rona. We were planning on doing a nationwide tour,
yeah,
and that was kind of going to be the thing. But we fucked that up by inventing the coronavirus.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But not knowing anything about a place has never stopped us from acting like we knew something.
I certainly don't know goddamn thing about Burgundy.
We did a whole season on German wines, and we don't know shit about that.
I've only had cider in Germany.
we don't know what we're talking about.
Is it obvious?
No, I just think that, you know, some of the cultural stuff is maybe a little dated, or like Portland stands in for a sort of nomadic aughts average whiteness thing. Mm-hmm. And a lot of those depictions or the bands that are sort of associated with it have as much to do with like a Brooklyn vision of that, or like a Los Angeles vision of that. Like the TV shows that were set here were all written by people from those places. Like there's not like a bank of TV writers that live in Portland to write about Portland shows and things like, it's maybe a little different than you guys think.
I 100% agree. I'm certain that not everyone's doing the Decemberist guy voice all the time in Portland. I'm going to throw that one out there. That was off my mind's eye.
Yeah, no doubt. And also, I've always felt like the greatest depiction of the Pacific Northwest, obviously, was the TV show Frasier.
Mm-hmm. Filmed in Los Angeles.
But they really, you know how Seinfeld, you're like, yeah, that's a New York street corner. The similar thing. That's what I'm saying. They have a lot of movie magic there. I'm kidding. We don't know what the fuck we're talking about, but we do. The truth is that I think, love the wines of...
The wines have been so good.
Yeah, they've been fucking incredible. And, like, we knew this. Like, the reason we did this season, and honestly, like... You know, peek behind the corner. The reason we choose to do most like seasons we choose to do is because it's something we're either super jazzed about or something we want to learn more about. And we want an excuse to try to fit more nonsense into our brains, and that
fun to have a bad wine. That's the worst.
I think that was what we wanted here, was just to learn more and figure out more. And are we good at that? No, but we're still going to try.
Well, I think that you've gotten to some interesting points with it in the first two shows. There was a couple of points that you made towards the end of the last one that I really kind of dug. Talking about the in the Genesis books, that there's sort of the pat on the head, or there's a polite. Yeah. There's a polite encouragement of go and get 'em, kids, kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. That's for sure a thing.
A lot, and she does it in Spain. She does it in areas of France that aren't as cool. She's in Italy a shit ton. Yeah.
I thought your comparison to the stuff here to Catalonia was really interesting. I'd never thought of it like that before. Mm. And I've thought about it a lot since I listened to that.
Oh, that's really nice to hear, actually. I'm sorry. the thing that's really struck me is this is not news if you listen to it, but how just new all of the traditions are in this region. Domestic winemaking is of course, there's a very ancient history of domestic winemaking. No one stop yelling at me. Don't write those fucking DMs. But for the commercial winemaking aspect is really young in a lot of these places. And just seeing what these the reason why we didn't really follow the appellations are because we don't think they mean anything. And that feels weird because there definitely is terroir. The terroir is phenomenal. The wines are fantastic. But it's hard to figure out what we're supposed to be getting because everyone's throwing shit at the wall and sees what sticks, which is kind of actually round about what today's episode is.
Mm.
I was gonna say I feel playing the Europe comparison game is really helpful with stuff sometimes, and maybe one of the biggest I'm not against that. It gets looked down on a little bit, but I actually think it's really helpful contextually. And, in Europe, so often, when I have written stories about winemakers in Europe, or when you're reading about winemakers in Europe, what you're reading about a lot of times is, the young winemaker who decides to fulfill his family's destiny, become the whatever generation with, great-great-grandpa's name on the bottle. And then, he worked as a graphic designer in Paris briefly and then decided to return to the vines, made the difficult decision to return to his family's estate.
All of them.
And that's just not the stories here, with very few exceptions. Really very few. And, on the whole West Coast, with very few exceptions. Mm-hmm. That's just not the winemaking story here. And you can blame Prohibition as sort of the original sin for the disruption of that. But what you wind up with is a lot of people who've sort of come to this as like a chosen profession or a chosen calling or whatever. And that informs the process up and down and left and right. And you're also talking about much more, I guess this is a loaded term to use, but middle class winemaking.
Yeah. I mean, that's not surprising when you're talking about an endeavor that takes money to start from scratch. I mean, starting a winery from scratch, whether you're doing something at a custom crush facility or whether you're building your own estate, even if it's a more accessible version of it, it's going to require capital. An investment of some sort, because again, you don't have that story of I'm the 14th generation, right. Which also that story is cool. And I understand why we like that story, but it's also it's romanticized and it overlooks a lot of problems with that system. And it also there are times when I'm going out selling wine where by the fifth wine, I'm I'm sorry, I'm repeating myself.
This is the
fourth generation winemaker. It was a lawyer, and he decided he wanted to go back. It's literally the same fucking story. And I just went from Italy to France, and it's the same story. So, that story is cool, I guess. But when you hear it literally 500 times, you're okay, all these people have just made a choice. They wanted to make wine. And in Europe, it happens to be well, my uncle's got grapes. And in America, it's I have to
find grapes.
Find grapes. And what does that mean? So I think that's sort of the thing we're not talking about when we're talking about this a lot of the time.
I mean, it's a lot more fun to talk about Europe in a way because, you can dunk on European winemakers to an extent you can't, because like at the end of the day, it's like, hey, fuck you. You know, you've got a lot of familial wealth. We are not the same. Mm, but like with winemakers that we've been doing here, like, it's been always felt very much like you want to make sure you present them in a good light, because like, you know, if you're like the marquise of something or other, like I, you know, and someone hears me call you like, you know, a loser freak, that's fine. But I wouldn't want some guy who has like a post office box in Portland to get mad at me, because it's like, that's cruel.
Yeah.
Yeah. You might lose out on the flights and nights at the Domain for calling them loser freaks, but you're they're alive.
Yeah. But speaking of loser freaks, this episode is the Brad episode, which is the one, like, we talked about this in our own internal cosmology. Chad's the one we had to do. Dad's the one that we're actually really excited for. Rad's the one that we're the wines that we, that me specifically wanted to do for the season. And Brad's the wines that are like, they're the uneasy ones, the ones that don't fully fit into other categories. And when I spoke to you, Jordan, you mentioned something that was really interesting. Is this like burn it down phrase that I've been repeating to myself, which is, you said the best winemakers in Washington are in Oregon. So today's today's theme is all about grapes that are being trucked, like nomad winemakers, wines that are in several places at once. I think it's the kind of jumping off point.
The other thing that I'm noticing as I'm researching, not just these wines, and honestly, like the wines from every episode, except for maybe the dad ones, are sort of in some extent interchangeable, or the only difference is like these ones have only been around for 2 years and those ones have been around for 8 or 12 or 16. Mm-hmm. But like, so many of these winemakers, like I've realized, this isn't their only project. They are head winemaker over there. They are part of this winemaking coalition with these other people who are also making that other wine with this other label. Like, there's a lot of people, like, to, I guess, the credit of this area and to what we were talking about before, there's people just fucking doing the work and doing a lot of fucking work and making a lot of different wines, making wines that are a little bit more over the plate, and then making this is the label for the wines that are just for me. And all of this feels like it's not unique, but certainly like the density of people doing this here feels unique. Maybe it's comparable to like the natural wine movement in Australia right now or something, maybe, but like it seems unique, at least in a domestic sense.
I see it as, if anything else, as being attached to the kind of horrible but also with some interesting cultural results, like 21st century gig economy thing, the like multiple views thing, where like no one job. I mean, you used to be able to be, you know, you could be a air conditioning repairman and live like Louis the Sun King, you know.
100%.
The U.S. economy and just sort of how money and wealth work in America have become so distended and like a broken slinky that now we're sort of in this reality where people are in their earning years, you know, and it's 2, 3, 4 jobs to really make it work. And so I think the consultant thing and the solo label and the main label and the extra thing you helped with, and you're the wine instructor at the Custom Crush, and you're the whatever, I see it being more as a process of some of that kind of gross economic reality stuff. Mm-hmm. But there's maybe some cool wine that comes out of it. I don't know.
Yeah, that's the best you can
yeah, I mean, it's weird. I've been rethinking about David Graeber's book, Debt, the first 5,000 years, which is a really good history book about debt. And there's this great part, which we don't have to go into, about Cortez, who's a terrible person. Obviously, we hate Cortez. We don't stand him. But something that's really interesting was that a lot of the conquistadors were deeply in debt. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the justifications for all of their brutality. And that's been something I've been thinking about as like we're kind of trying to turn our moral lens onto like how wine gets made and the people who actually do the work, and like the brutalities of the wine industry, of the restaurant industry in the United States, is that at every level, everyone's so terrified about what's going to happen to them and where their money's coming from that they are doing terrible things because they are all terribly scared.
Yeah. One in five of the Capitol insurrectionists had an IRS tax lien against them.
Jesus.
Wow.
That story came out today.
I don't know if that's good or bad, but I'm going to use context clues that I don't want a tax lien. Is that correct?
Tax lien is bad. Okay. It means they're taking money from you and stuff.
I was thinking like lien.
Yeah, no, they every time you drink lean, they take a little sip.
Not like gangster lean, no. Like,
So we're going to drink our first wine is something kind of cool. First, this is the Buena Notte, which, by the way, is so far the most interesting Sauvignon Blanc I've had in a long fucking time.
Yeah.
This is from Underwood, Washington. Jordan, is that where Underwood the cans come from?
No, I'm going to go with no. Okay. Underwood is like a very small, very, very small town outside of a like kind of bigger, cool town on the Washington side of the river called White Salmon, which has like a cute little downtown and like even some like boutique-y hotels and has like a little bit of like a come get away on the river thing happening at it. And that whole area of the gorge has a little bit of like a regional tourism draw. White Salmon has a really cool, there's like a really great bakery there that's actually owned by Josko Grovner's nephew.
Oh, fun. Oh, I've heard about this. Yeah. I think I saw pictures of a dinner there this year.
Yeah, he has a bakery and a wine bar there and, like, makes wine out there. Actually makes wine from Rebola, Gialla, Amphora with, like, the budstock that they brought over from Colio, from, like, the Grovner plots in Colio.
Oh, cool.
That feels very much like what we're talking about today.
Yeah.
So this is interesting. Like, something I wanted to talk about today and this is a good place to start off, is like how nestled all of these winemakers are into each other's stories. This is, I think, an interesting example where he obviously has worked at Antica Terra and worked at Hayu and worked underneath these incredible winemakers. And you can see like this project. So this is, from what I can gather, it's basically Italian varietals more or less made here. And that's a focus. And that feels very much like a version of what like Nate is doing at Hayu, in a different expression to me. I mean, based on one bottle, but still like a similar germ of idea.
And well, I love his name,
Graham.
He's Graham Markle, which is a powerful Pacific Northwest style name to me.
Sure. I guess my local intel on his deal is that he is nice and is a regular at these sort of tastings and thing in the city back when that was a thing that we got to do. And the wines are really well regarded here. It's popular shops. They're carried at the good wine shops. I would say it's probably of the like kaleidoscopic never-ending amount of new wine projects that have come out in the last 3 years, I would say it's one of the most well-regarded ones. When it came out, the first thing that was really around with it was his vermouth. He makes this really awesome, I mean, it's dynamite if you can get it, very good winemaker vermouth that's sort of in that Matthiessen, I don't know. I always pronounce shit wrong, so please, if you're scoffing at me.
Oh, we never pronounce shit wrong.
Yeah, couldn't be us. Yeah, I don't think so.
I have a really good mispronunciation story for when we get to the Alicante section that I'll share with you. Okay. But like in that
stuff. Does that have to do with the Analemma? Sorry, go on.
Like the Laureano Serres vermouth from Catalonia is really good. And like he makes this like Pinot Noir with like wildflower honey vermouth that's delicious. And if you ever see it, you should drink it if you like vermouth.
Yeah, who doesn't? Yeah, this is like, to me, again, this is, it's funny to dive into this stuff with one bottle as a representation, but I expected from the labels that this would be a pretty clean expression, and it isn't not that for sure, which is surprising because it is, you know, a little bit of skin contact. It's two different barrels with the varying skin contact on each. that were blended together. But it is very, if it tastes precise, like it tastes, I would understand why in a marketplace of ideas, in a deluge, it sounds like, of new wine projects. And I want to talk about that more as well, that this would stand out in the market as like the labels are clean and then the wine itself, like even though it's interesting and a little bit on like the cutting edge of grape varietals and winemaking styles, it's still like very clean and easy to comprehend.
Well, according to the Yakima Herald in 2004,
oh, wow.
There's a lot of local Sauvignon Blanc, and it's an up-and-coming grape in the region. 2014, rather, I'm sorry. But it said that most local Sauv Blancs are great value and are under 20. And I checked this on Wine Searcher, and according to Wine Searcher, this is the most expensive Sauvignon Blanc made in Washington. And it, one of the most expensive white wines from Columbia Gorge, Washington. It's in the top 10, according to Wine Searcher, which feels a little bit like, I mean, there must be some, because it was $30. But this is on the higher end for white wines from this region.
Have you tried to sell a Sauvignon Blanc for more than $30? Like,
you don't do it.
It's hard. You can't. Yeah, you can't do that.
And I read some more articles about from local papers about like how people spend any amount of money for Washington Reds, but Washington Whites are just in this hell zone where nobody wants to drink them ever. And that sucks. This wine's great.
Yeah, this is one of those things, though, that, like, I mean, I would be willing to bet that most people would think of this as less a Washington wine and more of a gorge wine, which feels less beholden to any kind of, like, state identity. You know, it's a little bit of this thing of, like...
It's a vibe.
Yeah, well, it's a, you look at maps of the world and like all of the problems caused by the sort of colonial parlor game of drawing up arbitrary maps of
name
their country.
Name three problems. I'm kidding. Yeah, there's obviously.
and it's sort of maybe a little bit of the same thing with this, like the, you know, the state thing, the of being on one side or the other side of the river when there's this very sort of open back and forth. And it's not like we have to go through checkpoints, or at least not yet, to go back and forth between them. And so, in a sane version of America where this was really more like a European Union with maybe eight countries in it, it would be part of the same country and just wouldn't be having the sort of intellectual discussion about like, well, it's from this one state, but it's made in another state. Like, that's all kind of arbitrary.
I wanted to go back and you made this sort of offhanded remark that I hadn't heard before about like, oh, there's been this sort of deluge of new wine projects. What is that? What is this vibe? I mean, as soon as you said
fun?
it made sense
sound
to
fun.
Me. Well, it sounds like, I mean, I think here it's similar. There's not as many wine projects, but like breweries or distillers or other things that like you're like, oh, all of a sudden there's a lot of guys who just got out of, you know, playing the markets and have money and they want to make wine now or something, or they want to make beer now, or like, and you can kind of tell that there's, it's certainly a golden age for that, but there's a lot of disparity between quality and it could be sort of overwhelming. Is that the vibe, or what exactly... what is it like?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that in a way we're sort of nearing like peak millennial wine.
Yep.
And hard there's a, just a lot of new stuff. And what the new stuff actually is a lot of times is from the same group of people or even from the same winemaker or winemaker or two, but like, the graphic design is different, but like there's not really a super distinct difference between what's in this label versus the other sub label versus the side project label versus the other thing or whatever. Not really, but the graphic design is different. And that is almost more interesting to talk about in sometimes.
Like, yeah.
Yeah.
We were actually talking with someone today, John and I, about the food world and how like so much of food, whether you succeed or not in like the restaurant world is like your restaurant exists on Instagram, and it doesn't actually matter where your restaurant is. Like, it exists in this digital space.
This is a very real thing. There are restaurants, I think, in every city in America right now that are better at performing their brand on social media than they actually are at making food.
Yep.
And it doesn't matter. I mean, it actually is the new version of what it means to be a chef. Like, it's not a thing to bemoan or say, oh, it was better before or whatever. It just sort of is.
Yeah.
When my ex's family visited a couple years ago, they had this long list of wine. They were from someplace I don't give a shit about, like Texas or California or something. And they flew to New York, and they had this long list of restaurants they wanted to eat at. And, you know, I work in restaurants. I looked at this and I was like, none of these are real. What the fuck are you talking about? Mm-hmm. Like they were like, not even like, they weren't even like the tourist trap restaurants. They're just like, what the fuck is this? And they mm-hmm. were all like places that did like TikTok milkshakes yeah. or like some kind of famous like cupcake stuffed within another cupcake and like blended into a sludge that you had to like smoke. And it was just like, it was absurd to see like, you know, like, watch the internet kind of chew up a scene. Like, you know, Kevin and I obviously spent so much time thinking about the food and restaurant scene in New York, and just to watch it get like turn into its lowest common denominator to tourists. I can't even fucking imagine what it's like for the wine industry out there, because I imagine it's very similar. A lot of day glow juices, a lot of stuff that's like, you know, like very fun sounding.
There is. I mean, I think that I'm maybe guilty, or it's just sort of how I think about stuff, that I'm very like generationally minded. Like mm-hmm. I tend to sort of how I filter the world. I think a lot about, you know, the sort of the Gen X, aughts, late aughts, we're going to break the rules and have a winery in the basement of a building. Kind mm-hmm. of winemaker stuff in 2008, 2009. When that came out then, people were like, wow, you're a Gen X bad boy who plays by his own rules. You're really changing things, aren't you? And they weren't. I mean, they really weren't. But nobody else was really doing it yet. And so it sort of functioned as like a placeholder for being exciting by virtue of it not existing before. It wasn't mm-hmm. necessarily good or exciting. And now there's so much of it that it's really hard to make a dent, or it's really hard to keep track of it. Whereas mm-hmm. like 10 years ago or 12 years ago, you could be making sort of glorified corner store wine or whatever, but because
I'm so glad you said that and not me.
You had like some tattoos and you like sidelined as a DJ and were mm-hmm. really cool or whatever. And like, or what, you know, you were a bad boy. You got to make $1 million and buy a house while it was still cheap and all this shit. And it's just this generational privilege thing, because there's a lot of really talented young winemakers right now that if it was 12 years ago would be a big fucking deal. And now they're sort of part of this bigger noise, and it's hard to pull what's really neat of that out of that. And I was glad that you guys picked one of Graham's wines to have on the show, because it is one of those younger winemakers here who like think the wine's really cool. Like, some of the stuff he's doing is really cool. And I think if the timing part had played out differently, it would be a bigger deal more places.
Yeah.
You taste a wine like this and you think about like, if this guy was a marquee of something or other and he was responsible for making the white wine in steel, the red wine in old oak, and then the red wine in new oak, and that's all he had to make, how fucking amazing they would be. Like you see this talent, and like, if they were given, like, they didn't have to do 300 projects, they didn't have to do XYZ and XYZ and XYZ, they knew they were going to succeed. I mean, you'd find a fucking Pufni out here, you know, you'd find a lot of people making some crazy shit.
Sure.
I do think also, like, I think you make a very good point about the generational divide and the differences that 10 years can make. And I think, you know, I think this happens in almost every sort of niche industry like this, where there's a moment and then there's a movement and then there's a deluge. And it's, mm-hmm. it's always like, you know, it ends up being to its own detriment in a lot of ways, because you think about like, the Brooklyn music scene, like Yeah Yeah Yeahs to whatever the fuck happens after Blog Rock. Like, it only took 10 years, and that was a seismic shift where, like, there were five good bands. Three of them were actually in Manhattan, but they all called them Brooklyn bands.
And then
I made a shitty band, like, 8 years later that, like, barely anyone cared about. And then there were bands after me that nobody cared about. But people still moved to Brooklyn to start a band because of that movement. And I wonder about that happening here. And I wonder if how much of that is because the history of this place is so short. That there is the ability to come here and create what you want to do the way that, like, an artist might have moved to Oakland or Brooklyn to start a band. You know, Portland was a place where if you wanted to start a restaurant, or if Oregon, if you wanted to start a winery, was just like the perfect place to go because you felt like you could be like a large fish in a small pond. And then that just stopped being true after a while.
Yeah. I mean, I think in a way, what you're talking about with the music stuff, and this is true for film and television and novels and contemporary art and all these kinds of things, is the death of the monoculture, like the mass access to all forms of culture and society open and available to everyone, which is good. Don't get me wrong. Yes. I don't mean that's a bad thing. And the like hierarchies of the monoculture oftentimes upheld people who sucked and just got lucky, or like had a cool story or a good name or whatever, and like got to be the thing. But the flip side is that, you know, you used to be able to go to any Sam Goody in any mall in America and buy a Ween album, or a They Might Be Giants album, or a Wu-Tang Clan or whatever. And like that put really interesting shit and like rocket fueled it through the monoculture so that it was out and accessible to people and was sort of had been ordained as being like available and big and cool. And now everything is available, and there's the signal to noise ratio is so fucking out of whack for like everything we consume. And I definitely think that that's the case for wine.
Yeah.
Oh, I feel like we're having this conversation with a wine that doesn't fully deserve. I just want to point out that this conversation isn't so much referring. I like this wine a lot.
Yeah, I think we're talking about this as being an example of a wine that could get lost in that static.
Oh, yeah, I agree. I'm just doing the due diligence of this.
Yeah, I think to say that 10 years ago, I think this guy would be a way bigger deal.
Yeah. This wine has this is a confidence I don't see in a lot of other, like a lot of Oregon wines I've been having, both on the pod and off, have a little bit of like, they're trying to show something, which is really irritating to me in a lot of ways. And this wine just feels like, oh, here's a fucking wine, if that makes sense. It's like, it's completely confident in itself, which I really like.
Is Sauvignon Blanc so uncool, it's cool?
I was just thinking that that might be happening. I remember like,
Zoomers like Semillon.
Is it the white Merlot? Is it so cool now it's cool?
Yeah, I think it is.
Oh, I don't want that. Because
Zoomer's like Semillon, but that's not rescuing it. It's just like the new one that like, oh, no one ever drinks this. But like Sauvignon, like good Sauvignon Blanc is actually kind of good.
Yes. And like Whitetail put shitty Sauvignon Blanc in every 7-Eleven that you could shoplift as a teenager or whatever. Like that colored a lot of understanding of what the wines were. And then you drink a wine like this and it's not that.
I think Sauvignon Blanc is the weirdest international varietal.
It does not deserve to be international. It's much of an odd bird that
of
needs
the
care
big
for.
Was it Big Five? Other like the Big Five, I guess. It's like the weirdest one.
Syrah, and sometimes Grenache if you're feeling frisky.
But it's like it's an intense. It's not like isn't it, it's an intense fucking wine, like. It's not like it's like you thought you adopted a kitten, but you accidentally got a lynx. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, 100%. Oh, we bought a zoo. I like this one. The acid's screaming on it. And it's funny. Maybe I don't drink enough New World Sauvignon Blanc, but it doesn't give off any of the common things I associate with it. Like,
yeah, there's no piss. There's no. I mean, there's some citrus, but it's like crystallized lemon. It's not like grapefruit.
I think if you poured it for me, I would be like, I don't know, it's from somewhere, not France. I would have guessed like, oh, maybe like North Italy or maybe like Austrian Sauvignon Blanc that I'm not thinking about or something. But like, yeah. I wouldn't have guessed Oregon or Washington, sorry.
The cliche thing, but I actually think it sounds really great, would be to have Thai food and drink the with Thai food. I think it would taste.
Some of those cliches are really fun. I want to push ahead to wine number two because we are in the cut and kind of like having a relaxo mode. But this is going to be a long episode by everyone's standards, and I'm cool with it. What is your mispronunciation of alligote? Is it alligator?
No.
Excuse me, crocodile. So,
I mean, I think that like everybody sort of has their own story for how they tried to learn about wine or teach themselves how to wine or whatever. And for some people, it's like, I paid tens of thousands of dollars to
learn how to enjoy something.
Any boomer organization took all my money from me or whatever.
That sucks so bad. Can you imagine like paying money to learn how to have fun?
That's like going to UCB.
Yeah. Right.
Oh, we just lost Miguel.
But like that was not my story. Like I'm somebody who like I just was like, oh, I really like this. I'm gonna read a lot about it and sort of just like be in my own little world with it and like look up every wine I drink in the back of the wine atlas and like
real nerd hours.
Learn from maps and like teach myself, you know, because I think it's fun. But when you do that, you don't learn how to say things.
Yeah.
And then you can set yourself up for embarrassing mispronunciations. Although I do think there's a little bit of like an embrace of the like bad American pronunciation of wine, which I think is fun a little bit. But yeah, anyways, I was at a very fancy wine bar in London I'm not going to say which one because I think it marks me negatively, but I was at a very fancy wine bar in London and the co-owner of the fancy wine bar was talking to us at the table. And I mentioned if he wouldn't want to try a splash of our bottle of Alligoat.
Yeah. Hell yeah.
He just looked at me. He gave me the most like beautifully witheringly English sort of look. And then was like, let me fetch a glass. I'd love to try the Alligoté, and I nearly died, but I guess I learned how to pronounce it right.
That's such a powerful like New Jersey mobster pronunciation.
Pass the Alligoté. Also, no English person should ever make you get in your feelings. They're not real.
Yeah.
Well, the English have the ability to insult you without insulting you, and they've like elevated it to an art form. And he got me really good. But it's okay. He also taught me how to say it by doing it, and now I'll never forget.
Well, that's cool. That's a lesson learned from the English. That's something that can bond all the colonies together. This wine is really kind of weird. So this is from Luke Allen Wild. This is the Lares wine. This is their 2018 Vintage Farm Alligator. And this was one that was. Did you guys find information about this online? I did some weird digging.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to ask. Like, I don't know. It seems like you maybe know a little bit about this, Jordan. But like, the winery itself is like a side project of a winery that's underneath the umbrella of a big overarching winery.
Yes,
it's like nesting cups here.
Yeah, for sure. So Luke has a winery around here that I would say is another one of the projects that's come out in the last, say, 3 or 4 years that's really distinguished itself as being really well regarded and making some great wines called Statera.
Right. And that's a Chardonnay project?
Only Chardonnay.
Yeah.
And it's great. It's really good and worth every penny, although I don't think it's even terribly expensive.
They're like 30 to 35 all of them. I was looking at them online.
And he has a partner in that work, a woman named Meredith Bell. She has her own solo project, which is called Est.
Okay. And correct me if I'm not wrong, also Meredith Bell runs Craft Wine with Chad Stock.
That's correct.
So we did last week and didn't even realize he was the guy from Minimus, which is why we knew his name already.
Yeah, yeah. So this is like a, it's like a broken social scene, right? Like
yes.
Okay. It's, well, Kevin Shields, eh?
Yeah, we got Feist. We've got
more average aughts white taste and culture.
That's right.
yes, but it is a little bit of that thing.
Let's say it's new pornographers. How about that?
Yeah.
That's like the American version, right?
Or like the Elephant Six Collective. Like right. Got Neutral Milk Hotel and then the Olivia Tremor Control and then
Elf Power.
Yeah. Oh, Elf Power. I have to write some emails now really quickly.
Sorry, we're gonna interrupt you a lot more as we drink. Sorry, Jordan. Keep going.
Those Gen X bad boys really played by their own rules.
I love your use of the term bad boys. It's like, I'm going to leave this recording and I'm going to say bad boys for the next like 2 weeks. It's going to be great.
Yeah.
Well, so powerful.
I've independently been describing the frogs I look at online as a good bad boy. Uh-huh. So this is like a really fun. It's cool that, you know, when ships converge onto a single point and they come up with the only way to describe a thing is a bad boy.
Yeah.
But yeah, they're sort of all part of that gang, and it is a little hard to keep it straight. Like, I had a minute earlier where you guys were like, do you know these wines? And I was like, well, I don't know this one. And then I looked at it again, and I was like, oh, wait, shit. Like, I met this guy. I know his wines. I know it. This is just his, like, new mm-hmm. solo project with a different label or whatever. And I hadn't had a chance to try this specific one yet. But yeah, he's a known quantity out here. People really like his wines, and he is part of the Chad Stock mm-hmm. Breestock orbit with that stuff through that project. And
right.
You know, I don't really know how much Aligot there even is.
There's one vineyard, it seems. So this is in Elkton, Oregon.
Right.
South
of Eugene. That's so far south. Wow. It's like, I don't think it doesn't even count as the Willamette Valley anymore. It's what they call the Umpqua Valley, which is one more further south, which is like almost all the way to Southern Oregon. Southern Oregon, which is its whole own world. And like, there is some cool wine that gets made down there and some winemakers in the Willamette Valley who bring up fruit. Like Brianne Day makes a bunch of cool wines mm-hmm. from Southern Oregon fruit. Like Cowhorn Wines is down there in Southern Oregon. They make some cool like biodynamic wine or whatever down there. There's a lot of industrial winemaking that goes on down there. It's got a little bit of like a Central Valley vibe in parts of it too. It's an interesting place. But Elkton
he doesn't make it in Elkton. He makes it in Carlton, no, which is so crazy.
Yeah, that's correct. Which is 3 hours, I'm going to say. 3 hours away.
There's it seems like one vineyard, the vintage farm. Mm-hmm. And this is this one, the 2018. I found another winemaker who used these grapes. Is it Kate at Gamine?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Who I think mm-hmm. is a friend of a friend.
Sure.
So hello, Kate. So this is her vibe on it, which is it's the fourth vintage, so super young, really fun. Luke describes Aligoté in an interview as a giving variety. He says mm-hmm. the clusters come in huge bunches with marbles for grapes. The juice itself doesn't taste like anything specific. Instead, it has the malleable quality of reflecting what winemaking was done to it, which is a lot of how people talk about Chardonnay, actually.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Aligoté did that respect. I mean, it's just mm-hmm. like Aligoté has always been that like lesser Chardonnay mm-hmm. vibe from where it's from.
But I can see why he'd be attracted to it because it's I like this wine. It's got so much more weight than the first wine. Like they feel like different galaxies to me.
Yeah, it's funny. It's on his website, you know, he has at least a few lines about almost every wine he makes. And then this one, he's managed to write 3 lines that say absolutely nothing about the winemaking or anything. Just like, weird little wine, only made 50 cases, couldn't make it in 2019, but I'll have some in 2020. It's like, okay, that's all fascinating. Like, what'd you do to this? I'm just curious. Like, I mean, it's tasty. I like it a lot. And it
I
definitely...
Don't know what...
Sorry.
So I don't know what was done to any of these wines. I the first wine is organic, mm-hmm. and then the other ones, I have a hard time figuring out what happened to any of them. Like, I have a sneaking suspicion these are all like, these guys are not really able to kind of dictate what kind of grapes they're getting. So I would imagine they're all just regular grapes, and they're making natural wine out of regular grapes, is what I think, but I'm happy to be wrong, and if I'm wrong, someone can DM me.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about that's like scrappy negotiant thing, like, mm-hmm. And that is really, with the few exceptions that maybe you'll get to, I guess, mm-hmm. in that episode, has been what, I mean, that's the story of a lot of these sort of, I don't know what you want to call them, middle-class millennial wines, mm-hmm. or whatever, is that it all kind of gets negotiated in or whatever. Mm-hmm. But it's an interesting thing to be like, oh, I got to make an Aligoté. Like who's like, oh, I really want to make, it's always been my mm-hmm. dream.
I can't imagine, though, if you're in a place like, you know, you're making wine, you love making wine, you have a project where you're only doing Chardonnay, and you're like, why the fuck? I have the space, I have the extra barrels, I have the time. Yeah. I know of an Aligoté 4 hours away. I can get enough to make 50 cases. I'll sell it eventually. Mm-hmm. It's fun. I'll learn something. Yeah. And maybe that is enough to be like, yeah, it's not grown, it's not completely organic, but they're not spraying the shit out of it. And it's fun. It's a fun to experiment. Mm-hmm. Like,
I'm baby.
I'm going to do this. Like, I can understand that from a creative point of view, that like, if I have the ability to try, I want to try it. And if I have very little to lose, then why not? Perhaps.
Yeah. I guess that's the flip side of it not being the 12th generation of a landed gentry plot of ancient grapes or whatever. It's that you can literally do whatever the fuck you want.
I mean, I think about when we talked to Mike Roth from Lo-Fi about his Chenin. Mm-hmm. And in a lot of ways, I think of Santa Barbara as like a weird, tiny version of the Pacific Northwest. Like it has, it's not that old of a culture, but it's got some like codified ideas. But also there are people who want to break out of those ideas and do weird shit. Him among them. And he talked about a Chenin. He was like, this is the one vineyard that isn't farmed organically, but like, fuck it. I wanted to make a Chenin. And he's like, I don't care. Like, I'll tell people it's not organic. It's not farmed horribly. It's like pretty reasonable, but it's certainly not organic. And it's just like, that's fair. Fucking make it. It's a tasty wine. Who cares? Like, you're honest about it. That's all I really give a fuck about, you know?
Yeah. Have either of you guys ever tried the Jim Clendenden Aligot, the Aubin Clément Aligot that they make down there?
No.
Cool. I think we've referenced them every episode this season.
Oh, really? I should have made another prop bet.
Yeah. You would have cleaned up.
But that one, cool.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's Aligot has a bit of that. It's certainly not the star power of Chenin Blanc, but there are like enough like, oh, there's some obviously very hip, cool Aligoté from France that you'd be like, if I can get a little bit and see what it's like, I'd like to know what it is. You know what I mean? Like from like a nerdy winemaker's perspective.
His notes for this wine are incredible. Luke seems like a really cool guy. He said this little stunner was not an insipid look at the grape at all.
Yeah,
that's the first line. I agree. This is not insipid at all. I think it's a lot better than not insipid, but I love that he's setting the expectations at that level. Like, hey, this doesn't fucking suck. I like it. I don't know what I expected from an Oregon Aligoté, like, which is like, I mean, I don't know what I've expected from half of the wines we've had, in which is like, this is back to our central thesis of I don't know what to expect because the appellations aren't giving me information.
And once you break out of the idea of Pinot Noir, what other ideas are there?
But I'm happy to drink the fuck out of this. In Oregon,
like the other ideas are, once you break out of that Willamette Pinot Noir idea and the vineyards that you're familiar with from there, because everyone's using grapes from the same vineyards. Then you have this like, okay, well, no one set up the rest of the ideas. Like people are making those ideas themselves now, whether it's like, okay, let's go to the gorge and farm in all these different microclimates, or it's like, let's buy wine from below Eugene and chuck it up here and make an Aligoté. Like these are all, there's no fucking rules at all. Like I wanted to get into this more in the next episode, but like there wasn't a Pinot Noir made in Oregon until 1967.
Jesus.
Mm-hmm. That's the first year they bottled it. Like it was planted in 1965 and they bottled it in 1967. That's like my dad was 10.
2 year Pinot Noir sounds really exciting.
No, it was bad. But like that's really young. And so like I just have to keep reminding myself of this. That's like even by American standards, that's fucking young and new.
Yeah. You'll sometimes get to try some of those wines. I mean, seeing the ones from the 60s is really rare, but from the 70s, and especially once you get into the later 70s, mm-hmm. you'll sometimes see that stuff hanging around, you know, wine shop will get a little bit of it, or there's a kind of Napa style, for better or for worse, hotel that's down in the Willamette Valley called the Allison Hotel mm-hmm. that has this great, when they opened, I don't know, they bought up some old guy's cellars or who knows, but they have a bunch of that stuff back for like you know, to like come drink your birth year or whatever mm-hmm. kind of a thing. But they'll sometimes have stuff open by the glass. You get to try it, or we'll be seated around every once in a while, and that's really fun and interesting to get to do. And comparatively not that crazy expensive, because I think people aren't really sure what to do with it, or like they don't know to care.
It's weird to be drinking from a region with like so much less institutional knowledge. Like, you know, like say what you will about Burgundy, but they get the grapes in the bottle and they know what it's going to taste like in 50 years.
Yeah.
I mean, that is what they do know. They don't know a lot of things, and they do some things that are very fucked up, but like they know this, and like mm-hmm. the institutional knowledge in this place is like all over the place, which is, I guess, maybe like an advertisement for having like an appellation that means something.
But how do you?
I don't know. I don't fucking know.
You just fucking make it up. Like that's my point. Is like
you get a king, and you like make the wine that the king.
Columbia
likes.
Gorge is just like, you know, I've never been there. From what I've read about it, and I've read a lot about it, it's like crisscrossing tributaries. It's two different mountains. There are, you know, grapes planted in completely different soil types. It goes from desert climate to rainforest climate. Like, how do you fucking slice that up into AVAs any better than just saying this whole place is a petri dish of climate? You know what I mean? Like, I don't know. I don't know that there's a better. I get your point, mm-hmm. I guess, John. But like, what else? You can't just make up AVA, like, oh, this AVA is known for Pinot Green now because we just decided it. Like, I don't know.
I mean, like, I think that's what they just did. And it's just, it was right in, like, the long fucking past. And then like, we put this mist over it. But, like, watching things happen in real time is messy and ugly. I mean, and this is what they were fucking doing in Burgundy 1,000 years ago. Like, that's what everyone talks about. Like, they're throwing a lot of grapes in the ground, seeing what sticks. And by what sticks, it's what sells and what people likes, not necessarily what's the best. Mm-hmm. And like, well, if I thought we were going to have 1,000 more years of history,
right?
We would know. We're not. We're going to get 20 more years of history, and then we're going to be killing each other. But like hypothetically, this is how an AVA. This is how an appellation forms.
Yeah,
is you figure it out.
Do you think the better option would just be to not have AVAs at all? And that's not a loaded question.
I think that, and we'll talk about this more when we talk about the last wine, but the process of starting from very large AVAs and then drilling down into AVAs within AVAs mm-hmm. is something that they're doing quite a lot of in Washington mm-hmm. and like further up in Washington, like within the Columbia Valley AVA and then down to Yakima and then even mm-hmm. smaller within that. And I think that there's a chance that you're going to be able to drill down some AVAs that are really small if you want to. But I mean, I think the other question is the degree to which consumers care.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like we're in a wine market where like how the art on the bottle makes you feel is what sells the wine to consumers. So like, who cares?
You're not wrong.
No, you're not wrong. And you're also like, yeah, this is what would please us three like insufferable nerds doing a wine podcast. It doesn't really matter in the greater scheme of things because like we don't need to be like we're going to drink the wines anyway. We're going to figure it out. The process of making an AVA become a useful tool for an average consumer seems, in my mind, in today's day and age, almost impossible, because it almost immediately becomes, just like a PR tool. Like once you really get down to it, it's like, well, we're going to make this AVA because these 12 growers got together. They're now a chamber of commerce, and then this AVA is going to help us distinguish ourselves. Like, it's just so ripe for being abused that it's like, I don't know what's better or worse, whether to have one that is just kind of bland and just is there, or to like start slicing it up and then have it be used for nefarious purposes.
It's crazy how fast people become like the bad boy of the AVA. Like, it's 30-some-odd years old, and they're like, we don't do things like other Willamette wines. It's like, what the fuck?
Well, right. Well, but I mean, places that have these really rigid hierarchies, existing outside of it is what's cool. I mean, look at Italy, like being like, you know, the IG, you know, like the Indonesian, the IGT ones, like not being part of the official DOC is like, where all this really fucking interesting wine gets made in Italy. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We're like in South Africa, like playing by the rules of the local councils, like makes it so you can be considered for export or whatever. Mm-hmm. But most of the interesting winemakers have said, fuck you for a decade, and their wines never leave, you know, like, so why? I don't know. I don't know if it matters anymore. Like,
No, it's weird to watch postmodernism happen before modernism happened, but like that's also the most postmodern thing possible, is like all of this noise before there's even a signal. And it's cool to be find everything weird, and it's cool to get like sad sometimes and just to get scared.
I'm thinking about how like I always bring things back to music, and I'm sorry, but like there was an article or a tweet or something that made me mad, where it was like,
I hate you so much.
An old guy who was just like, all these kids discovering music on TikTok, like this isn't how music was meant to be consumed. Mm. And I was like, go fuck yourself. Like, the concept of an album has only existed since 1962. Before that, it was singles. Before that, it was fucking sheet music. Like, music is music. However someone discovers it is fine. And I think about the idea of an album as sort of being this idea of an AVA. Like, it's cool if you can create a bunch of things together that make a greater whole. But, like, it hasn't always been that way, and it doesn't always have to be that way. It just, like, kind of worked for a while, and that's all right.
And yeah, I mean, I guess what this is probably needs to be said, but like, I'm not asking for like an Appalachian board to tell people what to do. I'm asking for an Appalachian board to reflect what's happening on the ground, which is hypothetically what happens in the good parts of Europe, which is like, this is how wine gets made here. The Appalachians reflecting that. If it actually happens in the ground, of course, there's always like politics and stuff, but like, no one needs to go there and like tell people what to fucking grow. That's psychotic.
Right.
But like, it was originally created to help people sell wine, right? Yes. Like that.
It is a chamber of commerce. I mean, that's the whole thing.
So if Appalachians wanted to exist to help people sell wine now, they would track Instagram likes,
100%.
That would be what AVAs did,
right?
Because that's what sells wine. Like if you're an old guy and you've had your estate from since the 80s or whatever, you probably really fucking care that you're officially part of the Dundee Hills AVA. And if somebody has a single vine over the border, it was part of the wine they made, they're out, and it really matters. Like, I guarantee you, for these winemakers that are in their 30s that are trying to like pay their student loans and shit, they do not care.
No.
Yeah.
And it does not sell the wine.
I've moved on to the third wine. Yeah, great. And I think this is interesting. This is a very interesting wine, first of all.
It's good.
Yeah. Yeah, this is so. This is 100 Suns. This is a Grenache from Yakima Valley, of course. You were sort of talking about how this is happening. There's a drilling down happening in Washington. Do you want to talk more about that here?
Yeah, sure. So there is this huge AVA in Washington that's been there since the 80s, and it's kind of a vestige of the like California industrial wine making vacation of wine in the Pacific Northwest in that era of like wine becoming a big industry in these states. And they created this huge ABA called the Columbia Valley ABA, which has like 50,000 acres of vineyards planted across 11 million acres of land and stretches all the way from the east slope of the mountains that are near Seattle to like the Columbia River and the Idaho border. Like, it's huge. But it shrinks down and then shrinks down even more and more. And like the development of those shrink downs has happened kind of in the decades since the original one was created. So the Yakima Valley ABA is like also really big. And then it shrinks down more to these little AVAs. Like there's one called Rattlesnake Hills, which this is from.
It's from there, but it's not. It's labeled. Not labeled
as the AVA, but that's where this wine is from. Huh. I don't totally know why.
It could just be that Yakima is a better selling point.
Yeah, it could be. Or part of it was over the line, or who knows? You know what I mean?
These guys are not Washington winemakers. They're also based in Oregon.
Carlton, Oregon is 200 miles away. That is roughly the distance from New York City to like the past Philadelphia, all the way down into
Atlantic City, maybe
like the Midwest.
Yeah. Like it's far. The Midwest. It's a 4-hour drive.
Yeah. Is there smoke taint on this? Like a little bit, or is it just smoky?
Do you mean smoke blessing? We talked about this last week.
Yeah, I don't know. We live in like a smoke cursed hell here, on the West Coast. Every year we have like a smoke season.
I don't dislike it. I just think it's, there's a very faint smokiness.
Is it the 2018 vintage?
17. So I don't know if 17 like, I was just looking it up and it said it was the worst year for wildfires ever until probably 2020. Yeah. So it was bad.
I wasn't familiar, just to kind of cop, like, I had never had any of these wines before. Mm-hmm. And I know I'm like Oregon man or whatever, but like,
much better than Florida man.
Yeah. It's hard to keep track of all this stuff, but I know the dude worked for Beaufrères, which is Robert Parker's brother-in-law's place. Mm-hmm. And
friend of the pod
was, was the subject of much, when Beaufrères opened, it was sort of the subject of a bunch of, like, I guess in retrospect, sort of hilarious, like, boomer wine controversy. Mm-hmm. But yeah, this guy made wine for it for a little while before he opened his own thing. And they grow their own wine. Like, he has his own little estate. When you look at all the wines on their website.
Yeah,
like
4.5 acre property.
Yeah. A bunch of it's from his estate, or it's from, like, other vineyards that are right nearby. And then also a Grenache from 200 miles away.
Like, yeah, they have a couple of weirdos on the outskirts.
They don't put the Grenache on their website, though, which is the ultimate stepchild bullshit. Like, everything else, all their Pinots are on their website. The Grenache, you can find it in the buying section, but it doesn't list the vineyard anywhere.
Right.
Yeah, I noticed that. That's interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I don't know what the deal with that is. There's Grenache in Southern Oregon, and then there's the Grenache that's up in Washington. There isn't really any in the valley. I mean, I'm sure somebody has a little bit somewhere, but it's not really a thing. And so winemakers that want to make stuff with Grenache, they're sort of inevitably trekking it in from a couple hundred miles north or a couple hundred miles south.
This was carbonic, 100% whole cluster, sealed tank for 20 days, pressed after fermentation, and then aged in terracotta amphora for 12 months.
Sounds like there maybe was a little bit of smoke taken.
And transferred to neutral oak. We're aged for 5 additional months. It's actually very delicious. I really like it. Yeah. it's a little boozy too. I think it's 14.5. It's certainly like showing it a little bit. Which I'm honestly, the more wine I drink, the more I like that in general. Mm-hmm. I'm just becoming an old man, but This is kind of a cool.
We're gonna love the dad episode.
It's
so
gonna
much.
Be. So, I can't fucking wait.
Actually. It's gonna be so fun.
Are you gonna drink Beaufrères on it?
We should have. No.
No. What are we doing? I sent it to the Patreons.
We're doing the Eyrie.
What's the website, yeah. Kevin?
Eyrie.
We're doing a Pursued by a Bear.
Uh huh. Sure.
And we're doing an Exumbris.
Okay.
Exumbris. Syrah.
It's patreon.com/disgorgeous. You could have heard this days before Kevin just revealed it.
Oh, was I not supposed to tell people what we're doing?
I don't fucking know what you're supposed to do. I don't know. Yeah. If you get mad, send Kevin an email.
Well,
it's kevin@disgorgeous.com.
It's going to be a snowy day, and we're going to get drunk. This is drinking these three wines in order. As a sort of idea, like, and doing these three episodes in a row, there's this snapshot to me that is coming more into focus of the area in general, of, I guess, this idea that no one really knows 100% what they should be doing, but everyone has an idea of what they want to do. And more or less, everyone is following a certain path based on that, where, you know, for the majority of these winemakers, they know they don't want to just, or they don't have the opportunity of just doing, you know, I'm a Willamette Pinot Noir guy. I'm just going to do that. I'm going to, that ship sailed already. They've missed that boat. And so what they have now is an opportunity to be like, what can I do to express myself with what is actually like a pretty respectable toolbox of grape varietals and terroirs and places to make wine. And it's sort of cool to see, like, to your point, I think, John, like, all of these people kind of figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
Today is certainly, the wines today certainly seem like people who are figuring it out as we're drinking them, in a way, mm-hmm. or people who are, like, experimenting a little bit more actively. And I think that's sort of cool. I say sort of too much, but yeah.
I was about to say that. Thank you, Kevin, for biting off my criticism. This wine's really fucking likable. Like, all of the wines today have been, like, likable in a way, like, that frankly, none of them tasted like a Brad. Like, the you know, when we first were coming up with this, Brad was, like, the striver. And, like, we talked about Brad things, but all these wines are actually, I think, quite pretty and fun on their face. Like, none of them are like deep thinker brooding wines. You have to like, wait a day before you think if you like them or not,
right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I had this sort of idea that all of these wines are either just on their way to being Chads or Rads. They'll be one or the other eventually, and they're like, they're just sort of new, or they're just sort of like figuring themselves out, but they will just eventually become that level one way or the other.
You live long enough, you die a Chad, or you live long enough to see your become a Rad. Yeah. I think that's how it goes.
Perfect.
Thank you.
Something about out here that I think is maybe worth mentioning is we've talked a little bit, and you guys have talked in the past episodes of this season about how all the winemakers are kind of working together and all the winemakers are sort of influencing each other. And I do think that that's true. We have really great access here to broad range of wines from around the world. Like, the import scene in Oregon is sort of surprisingly good. And it's something that I often will talk about with friends that maybe come here for a little while to make wine, or people that have just moved here or something, that like, wow, you guys, the champagne selection is so much better than it was like that I could get in Illinois, or like, mm-hmm. there's all this kind of stuff that's here. And some of that is a process of the wine making industry here being sort of raising the flag for wine import. And then, you know, the big impact of the sort of boom of wine import in San Francisco kind of bleeding up the road to us up here too. Oregon's a really great place to drink, like, for example, champagne, because we get all this amazing shit from around the world. It all comes from the same place. And we don't pay any sales tax on it. So you are just paying the sticker price on it. You don't pay taxes on it, which is great. And I do think that, like, that availability of international influences is an important part of the story of, like, the wines.
I think a lot about I think we were talking with Danielle from Forlorn Hope, I think, about how like they only just got like a good wine store in like Napa. Like it's like in Napa and Sonoma, it's hard actually to find not fucking Napa and Sonoma wine. Because it's like become this Walt Disney World, this like Times Square version of a winemaking area where like you go into a wine store and they're like, we have all the wines from here. And like, very cool. Right. I live here. I want to drink wines from other places. Like, can't help you there. Like, it's actually very difficult.
It's like a French wine store.
Well, kind of. But like, I think that's a very interesting point where like, because this area also, because there is a lot of wine being made and because it's not like hasn't been codified into this Napa or Sonoma idea yet. Like you still get like people who want to drink wine from other fucking places and not just drink Willamette Pinot. So it doesn't become this endless like, you know, reverb cycle of itself. People trying to mimic their neighbors over and over and over again. It becomes like, actually, it'd be cool if we try to do something from Austria, like that kind of idea, or it'd be cool if we did something kind of like this Italian idea that I've been drinking a lot of. Like, there's a little bit more room for exploration because of that,
for sure. And that kind of exploration is very borderless and sort of doesn't have boundaries. So you can pull a little bit from whatever you like, kind of from wherever. So it makes it feel like there's one of everything, or sort of a style of everything, you know. And that can be kind of fun. It's something that I've appreciated about you all doing this season and asking me to be on the show, is that I'm somebody who lives in Oregon, but I'm probably guilty of like, I don't necessarily always open a bottle of Oregon wine for like my own pleasure or like for to like drink at home or whatever, because I'm still learning about wine. I want to drink wine from all over the world. And like, that's fun to me. So it's been nice to get the context put back on it a little bit. I find a lot of times if I'm drinking Oregon wine, it's because I'm like writing about it specifically or sort of doing something around it for work or whatever. So it's been nice to get to think about it a little more critically or in a different context of you all doing the season on it.
I will also like say, I do think there's a good selection here in New York of Oregon wine. There are some great producers that you can get here, but specifically for this episode, we had to order these online from Oregon.
We could have got them if we waited 2 months for a lot of them. Yes, ordering them was a good idea, and I'm not like, you know, I'm not calling out anybody, but the idea was New York gets them at these weird spurts and start. It's really like getting natty Austrian wine.
Yeah,
like you get it.
You get it when the drop comes in. Yeah,
But I think if you guys, your some of that is your taste, because if you had gone for the kind of psychotropic, bright, natty juice, there's a lot of that from Oregon, and many of those Oregon winemakers will sort of anecdotally report that they sell far more outside of the state to markets like New York and Los Angeles than they do here locally.
It's amazing that I know exactly who you're thinking.
Yeah, I was going to say, we don't have to say the name of them, but you're right. Those are everywhere.
It names plural. It's not just
one. No. Yeah.
But I know them.
Yeah, we have a lineup. And some of them are fine, but like, this is more interesting to me. Like these, actually, this might be my... every single lineup has surpassed my expectations. I don't think this has happened since the Italy season as extreme as this. It's been really cool. Everyone's been good. Yeah, it's
gonna suck when dad wine's the best though. When we're just like, actually, you need to have an estate, and you need to you need to be doing this for a while, kids. Sit down.
You need to have been in the TV show Twin Peaks.
Why won't he respond to my fucking emails?
Jordan, what else? I mean, I think we can keep talking about these wines as well, but like, what else do we need to know before we let you go? Because we've been going for a while. Like, what else do we need to know about the Pacific Northwest? What else should we be looking for? And what else did you want to kind of say before you left?
Oh, gosh. Well, you know, I got to fight back a little bit at the beginning. I made fun of Brooklyn for being more expensive than living there.
I hate this place.
Yeah, no one in Brooklyn likes Brooklyn. This happens all the time. LA does this to us too. We hate ourselves more than you hate us. It's fine.
what else? Sort of try to defend some of the stereotypes or whatever. I don't know. You know, I mean, Modest Mouse is a band from Issaquah. They aren't even really, they made that one record when they were from Portland, but they're like an Issaquah and Seattle band. And they're like famous as a Seattle band.
Which is not the same thing as Portland. I'm just going to double check on
that. One's on top and one's on the bottom, but I do not remember.
Wait, Lefty Loosey, Righty Tighty.
Uppy Washy, Downy Ory.
Is Queens Long Island? Which one is it?
Yeah, I think so. I don't even fucking know.
No one knows, man.
No one knows. It's all stupid.
I was going to share one anecdote because for all of the sort of fighting back on the like stereotype, we're like, Portlandia was really written by shitty people from Los Angeles, which it was.
Yeah, Fred Armisen sucks, too. He's a terrible boy.
Yeah, most definitely. But we are expected tomorrow, and this is all still alleged till it actually happens. I mean, a lot of times people get worked up about it, and then it ends up being a big nothing. But we are expected tomorrow to have somewhere between 8 and 10 inches of snow in the Pacific Northwest, which for us happens maybe once a decade.
Oh, my.
Is like a major thing, like it's going to shut down the whole city and stuff. And so there's this sort of running joke about what happens when that happens. And earlier today, I went to the grocery store and it was true, which is that when there is a blizzard that comes to Portland, the grocery stores sell out of kale.
Oh, yeah. Probably no mung beans to find either.
This is a real thing that happens. I am a Portlander, and I'm grimacing through telling you, but I do feel that for all of the defense of where I live, I should leave you with this one very true and like annoyingly twee anecdote about where I live, which is that when the blizzard comes once a decade, our grocery stores get a run on kale.
That's perfect.
We run out of what's a cool thing that we run out of pizza.
We run out of pizza rats. Everyone buys a pizza rat.
I saw I saw three pigeons eating a falafel today.
Yeah,
and I'm gonna go viral. I'm gonna post this. I have to do it when I'm sober, but I'm really excited to post falafel pigeon.
Before we do go, I just want to go through the rundown of the bands for this week. Chad was Unknown Mortal Orchestra.
Fuck you.
Brad was The Gossip.
We've never had a single Chad. You know Rad these bands are was, Chad at all.
I don't know if it's RAC or Rack, but the people who do all those cool remixes of Rat-Tat-Tat. And Dad is Chromatics.
What is wrong with you?
I'm just Googling bands from Portland before every episode and doing this. It's really fun. It brings me joy.
Do you agree with these, Jordan?
The Gossip were all from Alabama, right? But then they moved out
they
here.
Moved out there,
I mean,
yeah.
That was like the shit.
Yeah.
Remind me, what's the Gossip's big song? Because I know that it's, I'm thinking of the Ting Tings, and they're not the Ting Tings.
They're not the Ting Tings.
But they're basically the Ting Tings?
They're not as, like, chipper. Okay. They were slightly gothier.
Going back to the monoculture being it impossible for anything to actually stand out, mm-hmm. There was this very, very good television show that got made, I think on Netflix or one of them, I don't fucking remember, called On Becoming a God in Central Florida. And it's about multi-level marketing teams in
was
the 90s.
Kirsten Dunst? No, who was in that?
Yes, that's right. Kirsten it Dunst. Is Kirsten. Mm-hmm. And Beth Ditto is in it, and she's great.
Oh my God.
Great supporting actress role in that show, and if it had come out 10 years before, she would have been nominated for stuff and it would have been a much bigger deal.
I'm gonna write that down.
It's very, very good.
Well, I think that's, unless there's anything else, I think that's it for this episode. This has been
I have a note.
Okay, yes,
it's patreon.com/discourgeous if you want to get the real dirt.
Yeah, and also the zine is actually out now.
It's good.
This
it's
is exciting.
Out.
It's out. It's good. And it's good. And it's out.
If you don't get it, email our intern, not us.
There are, we have stockists. Do we have a list of all the stockists on our website?
I do. It's on our website. I did that weeks ago.
Amazing.
It's like 80% accurate.
Cool. And we're already working on issue 3, and it's amazing. Hey, Jordan, you ever work on a magazine?
Magazines. No. Not really. We've always all done digital everything, although print is really great. when the pandemic came, I was very glad that I was not in the magazine business because, you know, you got to pay for it. But I like what you guys are doing, and it seems really cool. So no, we never were magazine. Well, we did our wine stuff, did a best of, but that was from stuff that we'd already published. We printed. My business partner loves all that shit. I would say more than me. He was like, "Oh, we got all this stuff, and we think it's so great. So let's make a year one, year two thing or whatever." So we have done a little bit of that, but that was very sort of promotional kind of thing.
Got it.
There's nothing like seeing your name in print. It makes me so happy every issue. It makes all the difficulties that drive me crazy makes them nothing. Just seeing my name in lights in the magazine.
Yeah, the magazine lights. Jordan, thank you so much for joining us. Is there anything you want to plug real quick other than the online magazine? Other than anything else?
Oh man, no. No, I think you guys are doing great. Thanks for having me, and I appreciate it.
Tell us we're doing great. We love it.
One more. Yeah, thank you. That was so nice to hear.
Jordan, this has been – I feel like, honestly, this is the first – I think every episode this has been good, but like I feel like we actually said information that was accurate on this episode, and it's – so thank you for being here for that, honestly.
My pleasure. Peak millennial wine. Have we reached peak millennial wine?
I hope to fucking God we have. I can't wait for the Zoomer wine, which is all like – it's called like goth bussy Semillon, and it's like and it's like fucking $400, and you get a QR code with it. I can't wait for that.
It's gonna be good.
I'm gonna be the Robert Parker of this. Like, they're gonna write all these columns like, we're actually trying to take down Duck for not liking our wine, which is conceptual wine.
That's it for us here at Disgorgeous.
At Goth Bussy Industries.
Jordan, thank you so much for being here. It's been a real pleasure.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Awesome. Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
Disgorgeous.